This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Free Expression with Jerry Baker.
Hello and welcome to Free Expression from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I'm Jerry Baker, editor-at-large of the Journal. If you're not already a subscriber to Free Expression, please do sign up at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you do your listening. This week, is modern technology destroying the lives of a generation of children? In not much more than 15 years, the smartphone has transformed our world. An ever-connected planet has shrunk distance, made complex tasks simple, and opened up a universe of information and entertainment. For most of us, our phones have become the essential tools of our modern existence. But the damage done by the combination of the ubiquitous phone and mass social media is also becoming clearer, especially for young people, for whom it has dramatically changed social behavior at a critical stage in their formation. Studies, and some of us would say well-worn parental experience, have shown that many teenagers and even younger children spend hours a day on their phones, scrolling endlessly through images and stories, propelled their way through algorithms specifically designed by tech companies to maximize engagement. Claims about the effect on the mental health of young people of all this activity are compelling. In the last decade, there's been a startling increase in the number of teens, especially girls, reporting feelings of loneliness and social alienation, as well as record numbers of diagnoses of depression, anxiety, and other mental illnesses among adolescents in particular. My guest this week has studied all these trends in detail and argues in a new book that it's time to do something radical to save our young people from the ruin this modern technology seems to be doing to their lives. Jonathan Haidt is professor of psychology at New York University and one of our most prominent students of and commentators on the various pathologies of 21st century Western society. In a series of books over the last 10, 15 years, he's tracked how social conditions, practices, and ideas have transformed our modern behavior, not always for the better. In his 2018 work, The Coddling of the American Mind, co-authored with Greg Lukianoff, he documented how student demands to be protected from supposedly harmful speech and so-called microaggressions, as well as many other things, were creating a culture of intolerance on university campuses. In his latest book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness, Professor Haidt takes on the technology and social media companies and the damage he says they're causing to the minds of young people. And he lays out what we should do to halt and reverse the slide. And Jonathan Haidt joins me now. Professor Haidt, thanks very much for joining Free Expression.
Oh, my pleasure. I love the Wall Street Journal. Very happy to be here.
Thank you. So obviously, we're talking about your book on the damage that social media and smartphones have done to the minds of young people. We're all familiar with the ubiquity of cell phones, smartphones. We're familiar, those of us who are parents, I have five daughters who've very much grown up through the smartphone era, familiar with the spectacle of them and their sort of near addiction to smartphone and social media. And we're also familiar with the data of the last few years that have shown these horrifying increases in reported mental illness among younger people, particularly among girls. And I want to get into that. But you write in your book about this nexus, if you like. What makes you so confident that this relationship between social media use and this dramatic increase in incidence of mental health problems, what makes you so certain that that is a causal connection, that it is actually social media that's creating these problems?
So when I really got into this research in 2019, after I published The Coddling of the American Mind with Greg Lukianoff, we suggested that maybe social media had something to do with this, but we weren't sure. And then some other researchers challenged us and said, no way, it's just a correlation, it's not causation. And so in 2019, I really wasn't sure. And that's why I embarked on cataloging all of the studies I could find, not just correlational studies, but experimental studies. And now there are about 25 experimental studies. And in the sciences, we know not to rely on correlational studies, but when you have a lot of experiments showing causal effect and basically none showing the reverse, you know, showing benefits, you start believing in causality. That's the first step. The second is that in digging into all the international data, because it's not just us, it's all the English-speaking countries, it's the Nordic countries, it's a lot of countries, the same thing happened at the same time in the same way. Now, if the null hypothesis were true, that's what the skeptics believe, that it's just a spurious correlation that, you know, moving your entire life onto a phone and not being outside and not being with friends, that doesn't cause any problems. It's just a coincidence that that happened at the same time. Well, if the null hypothesis were true and there was no causality, well, then the effects would be scattered all around. You know, some countries it would be up, some countries it would be down. Sometimes it'd be the boys who are more affected, sometimes the girls. And that's not what we see. What we see wherever we look is that it starts in the early 2010s. It hits the girls harder. It hits the young girls hardest. Now, that's not chance. There is no way that this happens in all these countries in the same way, just by chance. So as I've gone on and on in this and found that the evidence just lines up and lines up and lines up, and the skeptics have yet to come up with an alternate explanation. They can't even offer one. So there is no other theory on the table for why this happened internationally in the early 2010s. Do you have one? Have you heard one?
Well, I was going to put this to you, and again, I know you've been asked this many times and you rebut it, but obviously one of the arguments, there's an alternative hypothesis, is that young people particularly have been bombarded with information in the last 10 years or so about how terrible things are. You know, climate change is destroying the planet. They may not live or want to have children because the planet is not going to be inhabitable or they're contributing in some way to its destruction. We lived through a pandemic for more than a year where we were all told everybody was going to die if we didn't stay inside and put on masks. You know, in much of the West, we've lived through a crisis of confidence in the last few years about our heritage. And we've been told that all the things we took for granted about we were great countries and we were great civilizations have all been kicked aside. And we've been told, no, actually, we're terrible people and we've been the perpetrators of terrible crimes to everybody in the world. There is just this kind of avalanche of information coming from the media, which tells people you live in a terrible world. Why wouldn't that be a factor in making young people very depressed about themselves?
Well, so Greta Thunberg becomes an international sensation around, 2017, 2018. And then we get COVID and we have the age of rising authoritarianism. We have all that. So if everything was fine until 2018 and then the numbers started going up, I would say, that's a plausible theory. Let's look into it. That's the first problem. It doesn't fit the timing because it's not as though everything was great in President Obama's first term when we had the financial collapse and mental health was fine. And then all of a sudden, as the economy is recovering in his second term, everything is so terrible and everything collapses. So the timing just makes no sense at all in the USA. It also just doesn't make sense. I mean, I don't think kids in New Zealand and Iceland were suffering through as much of some of that, you know, in the last few years as kids in America and Britain. And a third reason is that whatever is happening, it's hitting preteen girls the hardest. Now, I don't think that they're the ones who are most reading the newspaper. I don't think they're the ones who are most worried about rising debt and all kinds of other things. So you list all these terrible things that are happening. And I would say, yes, I agree that lots of terrible things are happening in recent years. I'm very pessimistic about the effects of recent years. Why did they happen? Some of them happened precisely because we connected everybody on these platforms that do not give an honest representation of what's going on, but give a distorting mirror that is full of outrage and disaster. And who's consuming most of it? Preteen girls, well, girls in particular, are spending the most time on TikTok and Instagram. So I think that gets the time, you know, your theory that, of course, they're depressed, that gets both the timing wrong and the causality backwards.
I take the point. And I don't want to push back too hard because A, you've got the data, and B, I'm sure you're right. In any case, it fits completely with all sort of evidence and anecdotal experience I have. But I suppose there is another argument, which is that, again, and this applies particularly to the US and maybe Anglophone countries or what we used to call the West in a sense, which is there's been this atomization of society. It's been going on for a long time. Long before smartphones, we had, you know, Bowling Alone and Kaplan and all those works that were done that we've been seeing, I think, over the last 25, 30 years, really since the end of the last century. And yeah, or not longer than that. But maybe there is a larger societal disintegration going on that is certainly contributing to this, and perhaps technology is making it worse. Did you buy that?
I do. That's actually a major part of the story. We tell a little bit in the book, and we found out more since we finished the manuscript of the book. When I say we, I include Zach Rausch, my research partner in this. So here's the story. Since the 19th century, sociologists have been writing about the effects of modernity. It weakens religion, it weakens family ties, it gives you more freedom, more individuality. And so this is a long process in Western history. And which were the happiest countries in the late 20th century and early 21st? It's the Nordic countries, always top the list, followed by the Anglo countries. The US and UK are usually around like 15, 16, but you know, Canada, Australia, New Zealand are up there with Scandinavia. So these are the countries that have a lot of individualism. These are Protestant countries, a lot of freedom. And who's happiest within them? The young people. This is the universal U-shaped curve of happiness. Around the world, it's been well known, the happiest people are people in their late teens and 20s, and also people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. Those are the happiest people until 2012. What happens in the early 2010s is the mental health and happiness of the young people in these countries, in the Nordics and Anglos, plummets. The older people are not affected. So if the world was getting so terrible, you'd think it might affect everybody, but it only affects the young people. And so what I believe is happening, when we look at the fact that the people who are most affected within the US, at least, are secular people, people from secular families, not religious families, and liberals, not conservatives, not as much conservatives. You put this all together, what it means is that before 2012, societies and families with a lot of freedom, their kids were pretty happy. But then the smartphone comes in, rearranges life, pulls kids in, and it's the secular liberal kids in Anglo and Nordic nations, totally free. They're the ones who are washed out to sea instantly. I mean, within a couple of years, they start saying, my life has no purpose. Sometimes I think I'm no good at all. Whereas the kids who are more rooted don't get washed out to sea. They're a little worse off, but not as bad. So yes. My story, actually, in the book, we present it as two big factors, the loss of the play-based childhood and the arrival of the phone-based childhood. But I think we should add a third factor, which is that all of this has devastating effects in the freest countries where the kids are not rooted and anchored and constrained.
All right. So again, I absolutely accept the premise of the book and the analysis. But tell us, if you would, how these deleterious effects on young minds caused by this social media smartphone combination. Tell us how they work. You identify, I think, four particular sort of ways in which this sort of pathology works. Tell us a bit about that, how this works and what it does to young minds.
So there are four foundational harms. Even before we get to the separate effects on boys and girls, there are four foundational harms that are hitting everybody. And the background to this is the opportunity cost of a phone-based life. That is, once kids trade their flip phones in. So in 2010, they almost all have a flip phone, a basic phone, no internet browser. You can text, but it's hard to text. And by 2015, they all have a smartphone and they're spending a huge amount of time on it. Recent research shows that in America, at least, it's 5 hours a day just on social media and another 3 to 4 hours a day on all the other stuff. So we're in the ballpark around 9 hours a day. So if you're now spending 9 hours a day on this thing, which is solitary, you're usually sitting, you're swiping, you're looking, 9 hours a day, that pushes out everything else. I mean, there really isn't time for anything else in your day since you still have school. So what gets pushed out? The two big ones that are kind of just obvious. One is sleep. Sleep gets pushed out. Kids who are heavy users sleep less. And that has all kinds of pervasive effects on physical and mental health. And then physical health feeds back to affect mental health. So that one is, I think, not very controversial. The larger one, the bigger one, really the central one, is what gets pushed out is time with other human beings. And this plummets. This absolutely plummets. Young people used to spend more time with their friends than their parents did. Obviously, you know, kids aren't married, don't have jobs, they hang out with their friends. And in America, it used to be more than 2 hours a day of time with their friends outside of school. Once they make the transition, once we go through the great rewiring, 2010 to 2015, they're now spending closer to 1 hour. So it's been cut by more than 50%. By the time we get to COVID, they're almost all the way socially distanced before COVID lockdowns. So this is completely devastating. To stop seeing your friends playing around, joking, smiling, touching, hugging, wrestling, flirting, all that stuff, when you route that all through the phones, instantly, boys and girls start saying they feel lonely and anxious. And that's just two. We've still got a lot more to go. Three is cognitive fragmentation. So even in those countries that are not seeing more depression, like in Eastern Europe, all over the world, people complain, our kids are always on their phones. They're always on their phones. They never seem to pay attention. They can't focus. So that doesn't show up in the depression stats, but we're shattering the attention of kids all over the world. It's hard enough for us adults, you know, getting interrupted constantly. We go down rabbit holes. And we adults, we have a developed prefrontal cortex. We went through puberty in the before time, whereas kids who are going through puberty, and this is really the key, puberty, the millennials who were born 1981 to 1995, they're fine because they went through puberty on flip phones, which are not destructive. The difference between them and Gen Z is that Gen Z went through puberty on smartphones and social media, which fragments, shatters, scatters. So they don't really know what it is to pay attention to something for a long time. Oh, and then the final foundational harm is addiction. Most kids are not addicted, but many are. And across many data sets and devices, if we look at social media is especially a problem for girls, and video games and pornography are especially problems for boys. The estimates come out between 5 and 15% of them develop problematic use. It's a debate whether to call that addiction, but it is compulsive behavior that they try to stop and can't, that interferes with their functioning in other life domains. Can you imagine a consumer product that did that? You know, if there was some toy that interfered with the life and development of about 10% of the kids who use it, I mean, it's inconceivable we would leave that on the market. But we don't even bother age-gating pornography.
You have some very striking data in the book and lots of charts showing this extraordinary spike in problems with mental health, particularly in the last, I guess, in the last 5 or 6 years, I think it's the most striking increase. And the measurements of that. Just give us some of the basic data on that, how much of this mental health problem is for young people.
So for the boys, their rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide are all up a lot, you know, between 50 to 100%, depending on how you count it. Boys have higher suicide rates than girls do. So this is very, very serious. When we look at percentage increase, how much of a change has there been since the early 2010s? What we find is that the girls usually have a larger percent increase, not always. They usually have a larger percent increase that the younger girls, 10 to 14, usually have by far the largest, sometimes a tripling. Their rates of self-harm have tripled, which is one of the largest effects in the data set. So the increases are extremely large. We're not talking like 10, 20%. We're never talking 10 or 20% increase. We're usually almost always talking 50 to 150% increases. Many of those numbers are very steady from about 2012. It begins very suddenly, 2012, 2013. There's no sign of this in 2011, 2010. But 2012, 2013, all the curves start going up, and they go up a lot. And many go up straight. Now, I think what you're referring to is that for girls, and it's crucial, you must always ask for your graphs to be broken down by boys and girls. Never trust a graph that mixes them together because the stories are different. For girls, you do sometimes see a big increase in the last, you know, last 5 years because girls, there's a big sex difference on politics and on COVID. Girls were much more affected by COVID. They believed the mask mandates. They believed the full-on stories. They believed the maximalist case about COVID that was embraced by the left. Boys were more likely to believe the minimalist case that was espoused by the right. And we know from recent data in, you know, in the FT and The Economist publicizing stories, since the great rewiring, since everyone got on social media, boys have moved a little bit to the right and girls have moved very far to the left. So I think that's why COVID really affected girls a lot more. Their mental health really deteriorates. The other possibility is TikTok, because TikTok only becomes super popular during COVID, just before COVID, and girls are spending a lot more time on TikTok. So that might also explain higher rates of mental illness.
I don't want to overdo the playing the skeptical role, but some people might say, well, you know, there's been a kind of an explosion of identification of mental problems as being conditions. And, you know, again, I want to play the old man here, but, you know, when I was growing up, you know, and probably you too were about the same age, kids were miserable sometimes. They went through bad phases, you know, they're unhappy about things, unhappy about boyfriends, girlfriends, school friends, social networks, all this kind of stuff. And they didn't go and see a psychiatrist. They didn't get prescribed antidepressants. Again, this, I'm not necessarily making a judgment about this. It may be better that we do this, but there is just much more awareness now and much more of a tendency to treat what we used to think of as kind of bit typical sort of growing up issues as serious mental problems. I don't know if that's even measurable and to the extent to which you've looked at that, but how much could that be a factor in this?
Yeah, I think that is a factor. So when you and I were young, it was shameful to let anyone know that you were seeing a therapist. That would be very embarrassing. That would be a problem for a politician. Oh, he must be mentally unstable. So there was enormous stigma to mental illness throughout our lives, really until the 1990s in America, the move really gets going to destigmatize it. And I think by the early 2010s, before the social media age, I think the stigma is largely gone. So that's all to the good. And getting mental health treatment to people who need it is wonderful. But social media has this weird property that it creates communities defined by interests. And actually, we should point out Tumblr. You know, I'm always talking about Instagram and TikTok are the ones that are doing the most damage. But Tumblr early on, I think, really caused a lot of this because it allowed people to get together, not based on who you know, which is what Facebook did, but based on what you're interested in. And so there'd be all kinds of special interest groups on, you know, rock bands and sports teams and depression and eating disorders. And within these communities, because you have rating systems that give some people and posts more prestige, more influence, well, the more extreme you are, the more extreme your symptoms, the more recognition you get. So we get in some corners of the internet, we get not the removal of stigma, which is great, but the arrival of valorization. That is, and this is mostly inhabited by girls. Girls are seeing that the more extreme your eating disorder is, the cooler you are, the more people give you support, the more you get praise. This is terrible. This is a terrible thing to do to kids. Kids are incredibly sensitive to what's prestigious, copy the prestigious. I mean, we all are. But it's especially strong for adolescents who are, in a sense, entering into it. It's like they're landing on a new continent of life, and they don't know how to be, and they're looking for guidance. So part of my argument is that puberty is the most sensitive period in terms of brain development and the most sensitive period in terms of identity development. And these are historically times that kids were socialized by the adults in their community, not even by their parents, but by other adults and mentors in their community who helped them make the transition from childhood to adulthood. And now what we've done is we've completely abdicated that responsibility. And we adults, we have really nothing to do with it. Even if we try, whatever we say is trivial compared to the, you know, thousands and thousands of cases presented to them by random weirdos on the internet selected by algorithms. So the idea that we could completely change childhood, what kids do with their day, reduce their sleep, reduce their exercise, expose them to all kinds of weirdos selected by algorithm, and the idea that this would have no effect on their development or their happiness, that to me is a really radical proposition, which I think really it would take a lot of evidence to convince me that this massive change had no effect.
Well, we're going to take a break there, but when we come back, I'll have more with Professor Jonathan Haidt talking about his new book on the damage that social media is doing to young minds, but particularly looking at the solutions that he says are absolutely necessary in order to avoid further damage. Stay with us.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
You're listening to Free Expression with Jerry Baker. Don't forget, you can listen to the latest episode anytime on your smart speaker. Just say, play the Opinion Free Expression podcast. Now, back to Jerry Baker.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Professor Jonathan Haidt, author of a new book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. You talk a lot, and you have done here, about the importance to understand the difference between boys and girls. Can you just explain why you think that it is striking that girls do seem to, it affects boys and girls in different ways, but that in terms of those reported instances of depression, anxiety, social isolation, is that because girls are more, forgive me, I'm going to do a terrible faux pas here and, you know, probably commit a sort of what would be regarded as a sort of an old-fashioned, politically incorrect thing to say, but because girls are more conscious of their social environment, wanting to impress? Give us a sense of why it is that this does seem to affect girls differentially in this way.
So differences in ability between boys and girls are not generally very large, but differences in interest are very large and very consistent across cultures. Girls are more interested in people and the relations among people and who said what to whom and who is dating whom. Boys are interested in that, but not as much. Boys are interested more in things. They're much more attracted to tools and building things and destroying things and doing things outside together. So social media caters to girls' greater interest in social relationships, but it doesn't help them in it. It exploits that. You know, it'll ping them. Click here to see what someone just said about you. I just learned about this horrible feature on Snapchat. I used to not criticize Snapchat very much, but now I see Snapchat is terrible. They have this evil feature where if you pay $4 a month, you get to see everyone's solar system. That is, so you get an image of your best friend, and the closest planet is Mercury, and that is Tommy. It's not you. You thought you were the best friend, but no, Tommy is the one that she's most communicating with. And then comes, you know, Venus is Robert, and you're only Earth, you're third. And so this is just pure evil, to take adolescent insecurities about their friendship networks, to map them out, and therefore motivate you to use Snapchat to communicate more often with your friend. This is evil. But of course, this hurts everyone, but social media is just really targeted at all of girls' weaknesses and vulnerabilities around emotions and social relationships. And it just cranks them up for the company's benefit.
Okay, so what is to be done? That's the big question. You spend a lot of time in the book dwelling on this and giving your solutions. Give us a summary of what you think, you know, both at the sort of legislative level, but perhaps more broadly at the kind of social level, what we should be doing here to address these problems.
So first, there are so many proposals that focus on content. Can't we filter out this, give them less eating disorder content? To which I say, really? Like, you're going to accept that kids are spending 5 hours a day on Instagram and TikTok, and you're going to just try to make it a little bit less harmful? No. We've got to let kids get through puberty with lots of experience in the three-dimensional five senses world. So the most important things that we can do are delay smartphones till high school. We've got to clean all of this stuff out of middle school. Middle school is the most vulnerable period. That's when the greatest damage is done to the girls. Even the skeptics, the scientists that I'm arguing with, even they find that 11 to 13 is the period of maximum damage for girls. So clear it all out of middle school.
So just to be clear, this is a recommendation that school districts...
To parents.
To parents.
No, for parents.
Oh, I see. Not to use for the schools themselves.
Right. We'll get to that.
Okay.
So the problem here is a collective action problem, that the reason we give our kids a smartphone at age 10 is because everyone else did. We don't want our kid to be left out. So what I'm urging is we have to have a collective understanding of what has happened, why we're trapped. Nobody likes this. The parents don't like what's happening. Even the kids don't like their phone-based lives. They would like an escape. So if the parents would generally agree, wait until high school, no smartphone before high school. Second, no social media till 16. Do not let your kid on TikTok and Instagram when their brain is still being, you know, rapidly rewired. Keep away the random weirdos until they're at least 16. The third, which is the easiest of all, is phone-free schools. All schools from K through 12. The phones are useful for drop-off and pickup. I want kids to walk to school alone, not be driven. So phones are useful. But once you arrive, lock it up in a phone locker or a yonder pouch. Because if the phone is in the pocket, and if anyone is texting, everyone has to check. Everyone has to check. Otherwise, they're going to be so embarrassed at lunch when they're the only one who doesn't know what happened in that thing between so-and-so. So the research shows if kids have a phone, then they are checking it during class. They're watching videos during class. Doesn't matter if the school has a, you know, schools say they, oh, we ban phones. They're not allowed to take them out during class. No, they're taking them out during class. And even if you could enforce your ban with a, you know, large police force, that just guarantees that as soon as class is over, they're all on their phones. In the hallway, in between classes, they're not talking to each other. So phones in schools are a complete disaster. There's no counter argument here. There's nothing on the other side. There's no benefit. So that one's easy. That one we can do this year. And then the fourth, just to finish up, the fourth is far more independence, free play, and responsibility in the real world. Because we can't just take away all the noxious elements of the phone-based childhood. We have to return a play-based childhood. We have to send them out in groups outside to play without an adult with a whistle saying, no, don't do that. I'll mediate your fights. You know, what are you doing? Kids have to learn to be self-governing. And this is the essential developmental process in a democracy so that we can have adults who have learned how to be self-governing.
I wonder how practicable all this is. This is the question again, and I speak to some extent with experience as a parent. I know you're a parent too. And I think from what I've read, you have more success with your children in terms of depriving them of these things that they seem to be so essential to their lives. Because you know what it's like. You said it is a collective action problem. If one particularly hard-pressed parent going through a divorce or having other issues, whatever, you know, feels that just the need to give in to their child to have this. And the other problem, sorry to raise two at the same time, the other problem is that also isn't to some extent, aren't you sort of some extent trying to put toothpaste back in the tube here? This stuff is out there. Social media has been invented. A whole generation of kids have grown up with it. It's there. People are compelled to use it for a reason, not because they're literally required to, but because it is compulsive. It's there. It's very appealing. It's very attractive. I'm just wondering whether these sort of voluntary measures, these parental measures, or even school-based approaches, whether that's really going to be able to reverse this tide.
Yeah, it is like putting toothpaste back in a tube. I wouldn't want to have to do that. That would be a hard thing to do. But, you know, if an entire generation had a doubled rate of depression, anxiety, self-harm, and depression, if an entire generation was coming out less ambitious, more anxious, more fragmented, you know, I'd go to the trouble to put the toothpaste back in the tube. I mean, it can be done, and it has to be done. We don't really have an option here. We're losing a generation. The outcomes for Gen Z are so horrible that for us to not do something because, you know, it'll be hard, so let's not bother. I mean, that would be the greatest abdication of parental and adult and social responsibility in history.
So just to conclude, what do you think are the long-term, if we don't change course. And if we do continue like this and continue to have these kids, so many young people growing up with these various pathologies, what do you think it means for us, for wider society? Has this ever been studied? When you have a period when people go through trauma, I suppose the trauma of war or something like that, what are the long-term impacts on the cohesion and indeed the very values of a society that we're trying to build?
No, this has never been studied because all we have are cases of societies that go through trauma. And when that happens, it tends to cause a generation that has very high trust in social capital. You get the greatest generation, you get the toughening. So societies, there's research showing that when kids are young, during a time when their country is attacked, during wartime, like my parents were young during World War II, it makes them great cooperators, great patriots. They have an enormous sense of mission and purpose. So this has nothing to do with what happened to Gen Z. Gen Z wasn't hit by trauma. Gen Z was hit by isolation and aloneness. That doesn't energize you. That makes you depressed. The way to make someone depressed is not to say the world is terrible. Look at all these threats. That doesn't make people depressed. The way to make them depressed is to say, here, spend your time in solitary confinement. Spend your time alone on your bed looking at pictures of other people's lives. That's the way to make a generation depressed. And since that's never happened before, we have no guide. But I can prognosticate. The rates of depression anxiety for girls keep rising, and they're getting close to 50%. Nearly 50% of girls are either are depressed or anxious. So let's imagine a world in which it goes up to 70%, in which almost all young women are depressed and anxious. Now, this is going to have enormous ramifications for the economy, for their work productivity. They're not going to start companies because depressed, anxious people aren't going to be, you know, this fount of confidence and activity and careful risk taking. They're going to take safe jobs. So the girls are going to go off that way. Generally, they don't want to have children anymore. I forget the latest poll, but the desire to have children has plummeted. So we're not going to have many women who want to have children. The boys, it's not so much that they're mostly depressed. They're not mostly depressed and anxious. The boys are just mostly investing all their time in the virtual world. It's so cool. It's so easy. You want sex? You got it. It's free. It's amazing. They can now have AI girlfriends, especially once the goggles come in. And you can go out on a date with your AI girlfriend, and you can get a photo of you sitting next to her. Now, with advances in robotics, once AI girlfriends are put into convincing robots, the boys will have no further need for these anxious and depressed girls, and they'll just be off with their robot girlfriends. So I don't know about you, but this to me is a pretty dystopian vision of the future. I think we should put the toothpaste back in the tube. I think we should put a stop to this. I think we should say, let the kids get through puberty. If adults want to have robot AI girlfriends, I'm not going to stop them. But for God's sakes, I don't want my children to be offered robot or, well, robots I would see, but my children can be offered virtual AI girlfriends and boyfriends by companies without my knowledge or permission. There's no age gating anywhere on the internet, at least in these sorts of things. Yeah, I think the vision is horrific.
And as you say in the book, that you are very much knocking on an open door here, because I think everybody, you know, you speak to many more than I do, but speaking again as a parent, I don't know anybody who doesn't agree with either the premise of what you're arguing, or even if they don't necessarily always agree with all of the solutions, that this is a huge problem and we have to deal with it.
And that's why I think we're going to be successful, because almost everybody wants to change. I have yet to meet a journalist who seemed to think that I was wrong. Almost always they say, as you did, that they have children, that they see it in their own children or in the children of their friends or their siblings. So everyone sees it. Past moral panics were full of stories about a kid who smoked something and then he axe murdered his parents. And maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. It was one thing and it's picked up by the tabloids. And then everyone says, oh, we have to ban this thing that they smoked. That's the anatomy of a classic moral panic. A couple of anecdotes that get played up and scare everybody. That's not what's happening here. What's happening here is everyone has seen it because it's in about half of families. You know, when you have 40% of girls being depressed and anxious, that means pretty much, you know, let's say half or more of all families have a Gen Z girl who is depressed and anxious. They have a Gen Z boy who can't seem to stop playing video games and isn't doing his schoolwork. So this is not a moral panic with a few trumped up extreme cases. This is a pervasive change. It happened in 2012 to kids born after 1995. It's very sudden. It's happening in many countries at the same time in the same way. Yeah, I think that this is one of the largest issues we could possibly attend to. And we have to be looking across countries to get better clues about what works and what's happening.
The book is The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. It's getting a huge amount of attention. And Professor Jonathan Haidt, thanks very much indeed for joining and talking about it with us on Free Expression.
Oh, my pleasure. What great fun to talk with you, Jerry.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thanks very much indeed for joining me on Free Expression. I'll be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, have a great week, and I look forward to next week.